coming as soon as people have come in, and those in have gone out. Always a bit concerned just at this particular time. But it's usually the case that more people come in than go out. So as long as I make a profit, I'm happy. And as usually, there's lots and lots of space up front. I know it's like I must have a force field around the monks, and people have to keep 3 or 4 meters away. You're most welcome to come closer. If I was Lady Gaga or Justin Bieber, you'd be right in front. But I don't know what it is with monks. But nevertheless, okay, for this evening. Ah, very good. Thank you so much. You're so compassionate and kind. You don't make me feel I've been using the wrong toothpaste. Okay, so for this evening's talk, I received a forwarded email that somebody asked, please, Ajahn Brahm, would you talk about this subject? And I've been putting it off for a long time, talking about this important subject. But I was also asked to talk about this subject when I was in East Malaysia a couple of weeks ago. And I think it's the most appropriate time now to talk about this very, very important subject. And so this evening's talk will be on... Exciting, isn't it? This talk will be on 2012. They don't ask me this, but don't worry about 2012, because I'm going to just go further into fear and worry and why we use fear and worry, and it spoils our life and stops us being free and stops us enjoying ourselves. So it's not just going to be about 2012, which is coming soon. Only a couple of weeks, and it's going to be here. So is this going to be your last Christmas, or should I say Buddhamas? Is this going to be your last New Year? Is the end of the world going to come? Because people have been telling me, according to the Mayan calendar, it's all worked out. This is the last year. But, first of all, the Mayan calendar. If the Mayans were so smart, they wouldn't have been wiped out 500 years ago. So number one, did these Mayans really know what they were talking about, that we can trust them? Would you trust Julia Gillard or Tony Abbott if they said the world's going to end in 2012? You wouldn't trust them. And I think they have got better education than the Mayans. So, number one, where is the evidence? And number two, you know, because monks, especially when we've been meditating a lot, we can understand what's going to happen. And I guarantee you that the world is not going to end in 2012. And if I'm wrong, you can come up and kick my bottom. And of course, my bottom is very safe. If the world does end, I won't be here for you to kick. But I guarantee it will be exactly the same as 2011. Still the politicians will be arguing with each other. Still the Australian cricket team will still be losing their matches. Still... Still, you won't be getting as much money as you want at work. You'll have more than you really need. Still, you'll be arguing with the people you love. It will be business as usual. Yeah, we'll still have a few earthquakes. We'll still have a few tsunamis. We'll have a few of the usual number of natural disasters. But it will be as usual. Isn't that very boring? Which is one of the reasons people love to start thinking about 2012. It's just because we love worrying about things. Now that's going to be the heart of this talk. The reason why that we like to sort of start talking about these things is because we're addicted to fear and worry. And we just don't want to let them go. But first of all, let's go back to the Mayans. Because in 1969, that was actually when I first heard about that prediction. Because I went to North America. I just finished my studies at school. And I was going to go to university, and it was like gap year. I just finished a bit early, so it wasn't much of a gap at all. So I decided to go and see the United States. And it was really boring. And it's the same old as any other sort of Western country. But I remember going to a library and picking up a book about the Mayan civilization and all these incredible pyramids in the middle of the jungle. And I thought, I'd really love to go and see that. So, in those days, 1969, just buses were very cheap, and got to Guatemala City. And how do I get to these ruins? I had to get another bus to the port. I remember on the way, I'm just telling travel anecdotes, in 1969, there was this roadblock by the army because there was a civil war going on there. And they had these big machine guns. And they said, every male out of the bus. And that included me. And they trained the machine guns on me. They didn't know who was this Westerner. Was I CIA? Was I some secret service? Was I MI5, James Bond? They looked at me and said, no, he's not James Bond. It was really exciting in those days. But they let us all through. The people they were looking for, weren't on the bus. And from the port city, the only way to get into the jungle was on a fishing boat, which left just after midnight. But I always remember, there's one thing I always remember from my meditation. When we went up the Caribbean coast, just in the Caribbean Ocean, just next to the coast, for dawn, it's one of the most incredibly beautiful dawns I've ever seen in my life. And even though I hadn't slept all night, there's no way I could go to sleep because, just the natural sun rising over the Caribbean Sea was just so delightful, so gorgeous. There's no way I wanted to miss this. I always wonder that why people are sleepy in life, why they're dull. It's only because life is not enjoyable enough. We don't see, we don't even look for the happiness and beauty. It's all there, Happiness and beauty is right there. You don't have to look at it in your TV set on Nature Channel. It's right out there. You just need to open your eyes and you see so much beauty in life, which means you don't get so dull, so depressed, you don't get so tired in life. How can you go to sleep with one of the most beautiful sunrises I've ever seen in my life? And then we went down this river which divided the boundary between Belize and Guatemala. And that was real jungle. Just coming over the river. Now this was really important because the jungle in those days, it hadn't been destroyed by logging, mining or whatever. It was virgin jungle. And so, because it was just so much life, so much power in the jungle. If you've ever been to virgin jungle, you can actually feel it. It's got so much energy, so much life. And so all of those trees were actually leaning over the river. So I was going through a tunnel. It was like this green tunnel, and you could see the specks of light through the foliage as you went all morning up this river. And when we got to the end, it was on the back of a truck through these jungle paths, again, through tunnels of greenery. Because even if they did clear the path, a few days later, the jungle would cover it up again. So we're going through tunnels. It took 3 days to get to this old ruins. I always remember it's the city of Tikal in the Yucatan Peninsula in the northeast of Guatemala. And by the time I got there, there was no souvenir shop. There was no place to get a cup of tea. This was before those days. There were just one or two archaeologists who were just going about their business. And you were just there and had all these ruins to yourself. It was only about, my driver was going to wait for me in this old rickshaw. And there was only about two or three people there. Now, remember, at this time I was 18 years of age. What does an 18-year-old male do when he sees one of these pyramids? He climbs it. Because that's a male thing, to conquer things, to get on top of things. And But A, it was more like inquisitiveness. But when I got to the top of that pyramid, there was two reasons why I really understood what they were there for. One was because I hadn't been taught. I hadn't looked at a guidebook. I had no knowledge of these ancient civilizations. I know sometimes knowledge stops you from seeing the truth. When you've got no knowledge, you've got this open mind, blank mind. You don't know what to expect, and then actually the truth is really obvious. Too often, your learning, your knowledge stands in the way of truth. You don't see what's really there. You've seen what you've been told to see. Because I hadn't been told anything, I had an open mind. As soon as I got to the top of that pyramid, it was obvious. Because I'd been going through tunnels for 3 days, I hadn't seen the horizon at all. I hadn't seen far distances. And it literally blew my mind. It was awesome. I mean, and people use that word so often, too often. It limits what the word truly means. But it really was, you know, blinding. For the first time in 3 days, I could see the horizon. I could see distance. Because those temples were just above the tree line. And standing on top of that pyramid, I could actually see the paths which, you know, I'd come across so slowly over the past 3 days. It wasn't that far distance. Because it was virgin jungle, it was so slow. And I could see the paths all laid out in front of me. And the river, you know, where the night before there was a town in the middle of this lake where I'd slept the night before. You could see that. It was like, you know, the Google map. You can actually see where everything fitted in. The whole map spread around you. But the most important was the horizon. Every direction you looked, you turned around, you saw infinity in all directions, with nothing between you and the infinite. You saw space, emptiness, which didn't separate the world, but which connected it together. I remember once going to Singapore. We were going to do a little global conference over there. And they decided this ceremony of putting little boats in the straits, the Singapore Straits, to send the message to the world there was going to be a conference in Singapore. It was just a stunt for the media. And I say, these are the, and I told her, these aren't the seas, the waters which separate nations. These are the waters which connect the world together. It was just looking at the same phenomena, water, ocean, seas. I'm not looking at them as what separates us, what actually binds us together. Just like on top of the pyramid, the space. That's not what separates me from you, not the space between us. That's what connects us. And so looking at it in that way, to this whole vast, almost like a universe of space in all directions, infinity, whichever way you looked, it was not something scary. It was not something which separated the world, but which brought it all together, which embraced it, caressed it, and joined it together. The beautiful infinity in all directions. Now, I'd only been in the jungle for 3 days, and that's the effect it had on me. So I remember imagining, fantasizing, about 400 or 500 years ago, when that civilization was at its height, imagining that some priest or holy person taking a young man or young woman up that pyramid for the very first time in their life. They would have not seen the infinite before. They would have not appreciated space, because in the jungle, everything is so close. And for the first time, you can see space. Emptiness, that's a very important term in Buddhism. Sunyata, emptiness, space. Space is the only perfect thing there is in the world. When you put things in the way, it spoils it. Perfect, seamless, one, emptiness. It's beautiful. So I can imagine what that would have done to a young man or young woman for the first time in their life, to seeing such a thing. And seeing in that space connecting everything, nothing between them and the infinite. That's the problem with religion. Religion, philosophy, it sometimes puts some sort of barrier between you and your idea of the infinite. And what religion should really be doing is taking away the theology, the dogma, the ideas which block you from the infinite. And that's what we're doing up there on top of the pyramid. But also, you see the plan. You can see everything spread out before you. So actually you get to understand what life is all about. Why life? Why do these things happen to you? You know what you're doing, what the whole journey of your life is. Because I saw the journey of the last few days. I saw where I would have to go the next few days. You can only see that when you're outside, above, beyond, transcending the jungle of your everyday life. To me, that was meditation. That was spirituality. That's almost like coming to this place on a Friday night. Away from your family, away from your work, away from all the stuff you have to deal with every day of your life. You're in a pyramid so you can see more deeply. Above, transcending, beyond. And hopefully, with nothing between you and the infinite. That's a Mayan philosophy which I understood. And I never read a book about it. It was just having a peaceful mind and just walking up and seeing what's on top. That's Mayan philosophy. Not 2012, the world is going to win. And that's really a downer, isn't it? And that's just so naive and that's just so stupid. As I said, in 2012, it'll be business as usual. I will still be here on Friday nights saying the bad jokes as we always do. The bad jokes will not end. And so now here comes a bad joke for this Friday evening, which is what most people are waiting for. I usually try and keep it to the very end so people don't walk out. And I heard this, because last weekend, after being here, I went over to Indonesia for a conference. And this Indonesian monk, said this. I was really quite surprised, but nevertheless he said it. So if he can get away with it, so can I. Heaven. In the old days, heaven was a very wonderful place. A place of peace, a place of joy, and most importantly, a place of great safety. But these days, it's not a safe place anymore. Because there's so many terrorists up in heaven, you don't know when your vehicle is going to go over an improvised explosive device, or whether your mansion in heaven is going to get blown up. Because nowadays there's so many terrorists in heaven, it's a very unsafe place. It's an interesting take on things, isn't it? And well worth repeating to your friends. In Australia maybe, but don't do that over in the Middle East. But, I'm going to get in trouble sometimes. Anyway, same old bad jokes every week. But, it will be business as usual. But what really interests me in this whole thing, so for the record, I guarantee 2012, there won't be an end of the world. I've been alive 60 years now. I've gone through many ends of the world. You know, if you actually look at even the Christian Bible, there's so many of those teachings always get into the end of the world, simply because that's why creating fear is a way of controlling people. I know even then it was quite clear, and most of the people believed that the end of the world would happen before they died, in their lifetime, basically. And it never ended. In 1,000, because it was a big number, people thought the end of the world was going to happen in Europe, and people left their homes and went to the mountains. They thought the end of the world never happened. Then what do we have next? We have 1996. Remember 1996? According to Nostradamus, they worked out the end of the world was going to happen. It never occurred. Then there was Y2K. And then there was 2001, the Space Odyssey, this world was supposed to end. And then what was the next one? The world has ended so many times in my lifetime. And it's still going on. I was at last year, that fellow in the United States said it was going to end. I was at this year, wasn't it? Last year anyway, but anyway, it was still wrong. But, and now it's 2012. Why do people still keep on going on about the world is going to end? What it tells me is that human beings have this obsession about worrying. They just love worrying. They love to be afraid. They love to use that fear to be excited. But the problem is, Now, for some of you, you just take it as a bit of fun and games, but there's some people take it seriously. They really do get worried about what's going to happen in the future. And that stops them enjoying the present. And that's the big problem with fear and worrying about 2012, the world's going to end, something's going to happen, the biopsy's going to turn out negative, I'm going to die, and my wife, I'm sure she's got a sort of a, just the way she looks at me, I'm sure she's having a relationship somewhere, I'm sure she's, my daughter, look at the way she's sort of, you know, she seems a bit sort of out of it, she's on drugs, I'm sure she's on drugs, I'm not sure what's happening, oh, they're all going wrong. How much time do we get paranoid? And we get paranoid and it causes us lots and lots of trouble. So let's examine this. Why we like being afraid. Number one is because we always look to the future with the negativity which has been conditioned on us by our modern society. We're almost conditioned to be afraid. The classic story I say about this was once, I don't know how many years ago this was now, I was going to Singapore to give a series of talks. Now these were really high profile talks in Suntec City Convention Center, just me, 5 days. So the group over there would put a lot of resources into hiring this very expensive convention center just for me. And they, so it was 4 days, four talks. And they advertised this, literally, this was the time they advertised it on the back of the Singapore buses. I remember looking for one of these buses and I saw one, there was my picture on the back of a bus. Now I do remember growing up, it was one of those comments, one of those snide remarks you'd make to somebody, you've got a face like the back of a bus. And for once, it was true about me. I did have a face like the back of a bus, because I saw it. There was my face on the back of a bus. Now imagine how much that would have cost. But the problem was, despite all the organization, all the effort, all the advertising, there was one big problem. That series of talks happened to occur right in the middle, at the height of the SARS crisis in Southeast Asia. And as I flew from Perth to Singapore, I looked on the newspaper, front page, 99 people had SARS in Singapore. The government had closed all the schools and sent them home. And the government was advising no public meetings in case the disease spread. And I arrived there that day. So all the people who had worked so hard, who had given up so much time and invested so much funds in organizing these talks, they were so afraid. They came up to me at the airport gate. What should we do, Ajahn Brahm? Should we cancel? Have you seen the papers? I said, yeah, I saw the papers. 99, yeah, 99 people have got SARS. And that's when I said, what's the population of Singapore? I said, about 4 million. So I said, that means 3,999,901 people haven't got SARS. You know, they hadn't thought about that. So there's a 40,000 1-to-1 chance of not getting SARS. That's pretty good odds to me. You know, if you had 40,000-to-1 chance of winning the lottery on the 31st of December, would you buy a ticket? In your favour, that is. And of course you would. That's really good odds. So when I said that, they said, oh, we hadn't thought like that. So they went ahead. And of course, as usual, I told many jokes during those talks. Interesting, the first night was only about 2,000 turned up, then to 3,000. The last night was a full house. 4,000 or 5,000 people, I forgot what. Really big talk. And I told lots of jokes on purpose because I wanted to make everybody laugh. Because SARS was a sudden acute respiratory syndrome. it actually affected your lungs. And so by getting people to laugh a lot, I was exercising their lungs, making them stronger, which made them, you know, more immune, you know, from the disease. And of course it worked, so no one got SARS who came to my... And I used that. I said, look, if you were paranoid and afraid, you would have cancelled. And you'd have missed this wonderful opportunity to, you know, hear some, like, good teachings, inspire people. Why is it that we've got this terrible negativity? We look to the future, and instead of being reasonable, we look at what might happen, which is wrong. No matter how unlikely it is, we become afraid. And that is called fear. If there was an even chance of getting SARS, fair enough. You know, cancel. But when the odds are 40,000 to 1, is that worth cancelling? If it's 40,000 to 1 that you'll die in a car crash on your way home, would you not go in your car? Of course you would go home. 40,000 to 1 chance is worthwhile taking. And many of you take that chance every day of your life. So why is it there are some things, we look to the future, we add negativity, and that is called fear. Again, the classic story, which puts this in a nutshell, I read when I was very, very young. I was very fortunate to read philosophy books when I was very, very young. And the particular philosopher I'm talking about is someone called Winnie the Pooh. A great philosopher. You should read that. Number one, because you can understand what he said. Some of these other philosophers, you read them backwards and forwards and still can't understand what they're going on about. But Winnie the Pooh, he was articulate. And the particular story, which is a great story, simple, easy to remember, but very profound. He was going home from visiting a rabbit. You know, he was having some honey over there. And so after visiting a rabbit and cleaning out all his honey, he was walking back with his best friend, Piglet. So Winnie the Pooh, this big fat bear, that's why I always like him. I sometimes, you know, resonate with, you know, Winnie the Pooh. Tubby, wise, but always happy. And his little friend Piglet was very, very small. And like many small people, were always afraid of things. Understandable. So as they were walking home, there was the wind picked up. It looked like there was going to be a storm, and they could see the clouds of a storm rolling in. They were becoming afraid that the storm would reach the forest before they got to the safety of home. And indeed, they were a long way from home. And as they walked through the forest, the storm got so strong that, you know, when branches come falling off in the storm, and when even big branches come thundering down to the ground, and then big trees get uprooted, and you're still in the forest, a long way from safety, what do you do? Poor little Piglet was so afraid. He was holding Winnie the Pooh's hand tighter and tighter and tighter until he could go on no longer. He stopped and turned to his best friend, Winnie the Pooh, and said, I can't go on any longer. What would happen? What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And that was a possibility. If the trees fell, sometimes you're underneath one. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And for a second, but only a second, Winnie the Pooh was afraid as well. But only a second, and then his wisdom came through. He smiled, his fear had disappeared, and he gave the reason why he'd overcome his fear. He turned around to his little terrified friend Piglet and said, what would happen if a tree didn't fall when we were underneath it? And that was enough to get rid of fear. And that was telling you exactly what fear is and the antidote to fear. Fear is, what would happen if something terrible? And the antidote is what would happen if it didn't happen, which is often much more likely. So the next time you go for your biopsy, what would happen if it's cancer? What would happen if it's cancer? Answer, what would happen if it wasn't cancer? Which is more likely. Remember that and you don't get afraid. The other way of overcoming the fear is remembering, okay, suppose it is cancer. Suppose a tree does fall when we're underneath it. Remember the story I told a few weeks ago about good, bad, who knows? For those of you who don't remember it, I'm just going to say it in brief. It's a very good story for overcoming fear. It's a story of a king going hunting. On the hunt, he scratched his finger. He asked the doctor to come and have a look at his finger. The doctor sort of put a band-aid on the finger. The king asked, is it going to be okay? And the doctor said, okay, good, bad, who knows? You remember that story? Yeah. Good, bad, who knows? The king wasn't very happy with that, but nevertheless carried on with the hunt. When he got back to the palace, the finger was infected. You better have a look at this doctor. The doctor took the band-aid off, put some ointment on, and a proper bandage. And the king said again, is this going to be okay? And once more the doctor answered, good, bad, who knows? Again, not being very reassured, the doctor went away. A few days later, the wound was so bad, the doctor had to amputate the finger. And of course, the king wasn't very happy with that at all. So he threw the doctor in the prison. And as he threw the doctor in the prison himself, he asked the doctor, you bad doctor, you stupid doctor, what do you think of that, being in prison? And you know what the doctor said, being in prison, sire? Good, bad, who knows? A crazy doctor. A few days later, a few weeks later, when the king was fingered healed, he was off hunting again. He got separated from the rest of the party, got lost in the jungle, got captured by the forest people who wanted to sacrifice him to their god. It was a holy day. They captured him and had a human sacrifice. They tied him to a tree. They danced around until someone saw he'd lost a finger. He only had 9 fingers. Now, when you do, even sometimes people do offerings to the Buddha, it's always the best food. It has to be perfect before you make an offering. The same in those religions too. If it's imperfect, it's not worth offering to a god. So as soon as they saw he was imperfect, only had 9 fingers, they said, we can't offer him to the god. He's not perfect enough. And that's why they set him free. And he realized he'd escaped with his life because he'd lost a finger. Losing a finger was good. Saved his life. He realized that that doctor was wise, not stupid. So he went back to the palace, freed the doctor and said, it's a terrible thing I did. I shouldn't have put you in jail. You were very, very wise. I thought losing a finger was bad, but it's actually good. It saved my life. And the doctor replied, remember this? What do you mean putting me in jail was bad? It was good I was in jail. I'll tell you why it was good I was in jail, because if I wasn't in jail, I'd be on the hunt with you. I'd have been captured too, and I've got 10 fingers. Remember that story. It's a beautiful story. So why are you afraid? If a tree does fall when you're underneath it, good, bad, who knows? Because that's why we assume in the future it's going to be bad. What happens if, you know, have you got your TEE results yet? Is it coming out yet? What happens if you fail? Is that going to be good, bad? Who knows? Steve Jobs, sacked from Apple. Good, bad. He thought it was bad at the time. It was good for him. So often, we're afraid of the future because afraid of what's going to happen. We look to the future. That's our first mistake. And we add negativity. Number one, the bad things probably don't happen anyway. And number two, if they do happen, it could be the best thing which ever happened to you in your life. At the time, it looks bad. But really, if you're wise, good, bad, who knows? Imagine you can get that in your head. You'd have no worry about the future at all. You wouldn't be paranoid. If the world does end in 2012, good, bad, who knows? Well, go end someday, might as well 2012. Let's get out of here. At least I won't have any worries anymore about raising funds for this and raising funds for that. I won't have to worry about building the nuns' monastery. You don't have to worry about finding a committee for next year. Great. But good, bad, who knows? We can actually let it go. But the worst part of this worry business is, again, we're wasting so much time. Now, life, as John Lennon says, is what happens when you're busy worrying about something else. He didn't actually say that, but that's what he meant. Life is what happens when you're busy worrying about something else. Why are you so worried about the future anyway? It means you're not living life right now. As the Dalai Lama used to say, if you can do something about the future, then worry about it. Fair enough. But can you do something about the future? A lot of time, all of your worry is for no practical purpose. Which is why the second powerful story, or the third or the fourth, I've lost count, is this great little anecdote from that British Prime Minister who during the Six-Day War in 1966 or something, 67, thank you, close enough, not bad actually for someone over 60 years of age, 66, 67. But anyway, 1967, the Six-Day War, this big battle between Israel and Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, a big war in the Middle East. And they asked this Prime Minister of England, interview in the newspapers, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? And he gave this answer, brilliant answer. He said, sir, there is no problem in the Middle East. Wow. What did he mean? Because there's a war going on. And the journalists say, what do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? There are tank battles. People are shooting each other. People are dying. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? And this wise statesman, and I always remember this, this actually is one of the key stories of my life. He said, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem. Now, isn't that brilliant? Because you cannot, that makes sense, doesn't it? That is logical, reasonable, and if you take that on board, you'll have a much happier life. A problem is something with a solution. Many of the things you worry about, they're not problems. You know why? Because there's no solution. If you can see a solution, then it's a problem. Then worry about it. Fix it. But so much of in life is not a problem. But we still worry about it anyway. That's the problem. So, be efficient. Because what he was actually saying, look, he was a prime minister, or just an ex-prime minister. He had a lot of responsibilities. Why waste your mental energy, your physical energy, your time, on things where you can't make a difference, where you can't make any positive contribution? Wouldn't it be much better spending that time doing something where you can make a difference, solving a problem which has got a solution? Too often we worry about things which haven't got solutions, wasting time and neglecting things where we could make a much better contribution to our world, to our life, to our happiness, to our health. That is the problem. We're wasting time. Now we understand that. So much worry about the future, the end of the world, 2012. If it is going to happen, can you change it? Is it a real problem? Can you, if the world is going to end, can you stop it? Of course you can. If it's going to end, you can't stop it anyway, so it's not a problem, is it? So stop worrying about it. Are you going to die? Fortunately, did you say? Well done. Marvellous. I didn't hear the first. Dying. Good, bad? Who knows? Yeah, excellent. You're learning. So your mother dies? Your father dies? Is that bad? Good, bad, who knows? Remember that. They may leave you a lot of money in their will. But we get this idea, it's bad. There are certain things we've been taught is bad. I know that happens a lot. You know, somebody dies and you say, oh, my mother died. And say, oh, I'm so sorry. What do you mean you're sorry, so sorry? You don't even know her. You never met her. You don't know. Why do you say, I'm so sorry? It could be the great release. Your mother may have been suffering for years, and now she's dead, she's released from her pain. Why do people say automatically, "I'm so sorry"? This is the problem, our conditioning, our habitual tendencies. Well, our society has actually brainwashed us. Death is sad. So when somebody dies, "Oh, I'm so sorry." No, don't say that. You don't know. Instead, say, "Oh, you're dead, good, bad, who knows?" Now you're wise, now you're getting somewhere. If people don't understand, you can't do anything about that, so it's not a problem. Same with so much of my life. There's so many problems in the world, so many things you should be doing, but you know, you can't do anything about it. So I make sure I'm a very busy monk, got so much stuff to do, so many talks to give, so many books to write, so many stuff to do. I make sure I'm efficient. If there's something I can't do anything about, it's not a problem, because it's not got a solution, so I don't even think about it. That means I've got much more peace in my life. Because I realize worrying about the future is a wrong thing to do. It is, you seem to that years ago through your meditation. Worrying about what's going to happen next stops you enjoying this moment. Every evening when I come up here to give a talk, I haven't got much of an idea what I'm going to talk about. Maybe you've got a title, maybe someone said, "No, please talk about 2012. Yeah, you've got something to start with, but I never know where I'm going to end up, where you're going to finish. And I don't worry. I don't worry about what I'm going to say. Years ago, I worked it out. For me, giving a talk is always win-win. If you don't like the talk, if I'm the most boring speaker, if it's just really a terrible talk, makes terrible sense, and it's so boring you all fall asleep, brilliant, I win. I can have a rest. I don't have to come up here every weekend on a Friday night. I can stay in my kuti, stay in my hut, and meditate and have a great time. So if you don't like my talks, that's brilliant. That's awesome. If you like my talks, that's wonderful. I can inspire you. I get a lot of happiness making other people happy. So either way, I win. That's my habit in life. I don't worry, because no matter what happens, and if I just say something stupid, I've been on TV a couple of times, live TV. In live TV, you put your feet, oops, I shouldn't have done that, live TV. Actually, this is live TV. This goes on the internet. If you make a mistake, a lot of people get embarrassed. They're afraid of making mistakes. For me, if I'm making mistakes, it makes people laugh. It makes them happy. What a wonderful thing it is to make people laugh. So that's a wonderful thing you can do in life. You're not afraid at all. When you're afraid, it means you can't perform to your highest potential. So one way of overcoming that fear, don't know why you're afraid anyway, you realize it's just stopping you enjoying life, being successful, and being healthy. Please stay more in the present moment. A lot of the future, worrying about it, you can't do anything about it anyway, so leave it alone. Worrying about whether my aircraft will leave on time, I can't do anything about it. If it's late, it's late. All my worry, all my banging on the table, all my going up to see the person behind the counter. You can't make this plane late. I've got an appointment. I've got to get somewhere. All you ever achieve by that is getting a sore hand. I did that then. So, you can't change anything. Leave it alone. And who knows what's going to happen? Good, bad, who knows? But the more you spend in this present moment enjoying this life, isn't that the best you're going to do? If this world is going to end, which it won't, still, it's a great thing to think, you've only got 11 months. When is it? Somebody said the October, wasn't it? The 2012, the December the 21, thank you so much. Actually, what day is it today? It's almost just 1 year, your birthday. Amazing, you get special. You're going to have the biggest birthday of your life, the whole Earth is going to explode in fireworks. You're going to have a wonderful time. 21st of the 12th. So you've only got 1 year left. So what are you going to do in your last year? Now that's actually one good thing. Again, one other prediction. There was this very famous monk in the north of Thailand. My 5 years as a monk. He was one of these monks respected, and I got the word. He said, like in Thailand, they've got this rocket festival, and about, was it March or February, March? Every year, the Bung Fai Festival. That's like a rocket festival. And they said, next year, he said, it's going to be the biggest rocket festival in the whole world. And everybody understood that to mean a nuclear war. He predicted that. Now, when I heard that, that's absolutely ridiculous. Even though he's a very holy monk, you know, even holy monks make mistakes. So I didn't really sort of think twice about it. But I thought, why not make use of that? So I thought, maybe, you know, the world might end. So I made that year a really good year. I made sure that every day of that year, every hour, every minute of that year, I never wasted. Now that is using the end of the world idea in a positive way. Because, you know, the world is going to end one day for you. Actually, I still remember when we used to live in Magnolia Street. And we used to come up on Friday, stay the weekend, and on early Monday morning, go back to Serpentine to do the building work. And I think every, actually it was Sunday afternoon. Because every day on Sunday afternoon, there was a fellow, some of you may remember him, he was on the corner of Charles Street and Vincent Street. That's right, Charles and Vincent Street, with a big poster, the end of the world is nigh, the end of the world is nigh. We always remember, because we'd come past about the same time every week, we'd wave to him, and he'd wave, because we'd put his mugs in there to stir him up, to give him a hard time. But actually, one day, he wasn't there anymore. Apparently, it was in the newspaper, he actually got hit by a car, carrying the sign. So his prediction was right. That day, the end of the world for him anyway, was nigh. Poor guy. But anyway, just seeing all that, is just what I use for that is, yes, you know, my life, my death is going to, you know, come sooner or later, the end of my life. So I'm going to make sure every moment I'm going to use wisely. You know, if you really want to have a nice day today. You want to say to someone you love them so much, say it right now. Say to them, the end of the world might come next week. If you want to say sorry to someone, do it now. If you want to make sure you paid up all your subscriptions to the Buddha Society of Western Australia, do it now. If you want to give a donation to the Bangladesh orphanage to help these poor kids in the last year of life, 2012, do it now. But the most important thing, he's actually understanding just how, like, time goes so quickly, how, you know, my end will come soon. That really does make life more interesting, more alive. So, yeah, make use of it. Don't be afraid and allow it to stop you enjoying your life. Make it so it enhances your life, gives it more energy, more importance. That's why so often, actually this is part of Buddha's teachings, especially for monks, every day when you wake up, you think, maybe this is my last day. What do I want to do the last day of my life? If this was the last day of your life, what would you do? How would you live it? And if you live every day as if it's the end of the world coming tomorrow, then you'll be a very wise, happy, rich person. You would be rich. Remember that one of my favorite sayings I say every other week? Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because the end of the world might be coming tonight. In other words, get the important things done. You know, your life, your meditation, your love, your family, all this other stuff, you know, which we waste so much time on. Is it really important? So the end of the world, get that in your head, it really makes what's really important come to the front. And what's sort of, you know, secondary importance, which is what we spend most of our time on, that gets, you know, relegated way down the list of to-do things. So one of the nice things about end of the world is, yeah, we're not afraid. We're not sort of worrying about things we can't change. We're not going off into the future and, you know, worrying about what's going to happen. We're right in this present moment. This is the only time we have. It's running out. Who knows when the world's going to end? Let's make today, tonight, this moment, right now, the most beautiful, peaceful, happy, joyful moment we possibly can. If you understand that, you can't get angry at anybody. You've got no time to be angry. Because when you get angry at one person, it takes such a long time to fix up afterwards. You can't even get angry at yourself. I've got no time to waste getting angry at myself. I've got no time to be afraid. I'm going to take every moment and live it to the full. Squeeze all the juice out of this moment. That actually gives me another sort of joke about this guy goes into a bar and the barman has got this standing bet. Once he's made a cocktail for someone, if anyone can squeeze any more juice out of the lemon, they get a free drink. And many of these big guys, these big miners, plumbers, bricklayers, have gone in there trying to squeeze, you know, some more juice out after, you know, the bartender has made the martini or whatever. And no one can ever do it because this bartender is so strong. And one day this thin, scrawny guy in a suit comes in and says, "I'll do it." And they think, all these big guys, these big muscular guys, they've never been able to squeeze any juice out of the lemon after you've squeezed it. And he said, "I can." So this scrawny guy in a suit gets a lemon. One drop, two drops, three drops. About six drops he squeezed out. The only fellow to do that. And he said, "My goodness, no one's ever been able to do that. What do you do?" And he says, "I work for the tax office." I do apologize to anyone who works for the tax office. Squeezing more drops out of people when you can't. You see, so the world will never change. I'll say even worse jokes next year, I absolutely promise. And in 2013 and in 2014 as well. So, the whole story this evening, no need to worry about the end of the world. Remember that many, all that fear and anxiety which you have is all about looking to the future and putting something negative at the end. Remember Winnie the Pooh. Instead of saying, what would happen? Something terrible happened. So what if it didn't happen? Even working out the odds, like I did in the SARS crisis. Even better, no matter what happens, you don't know whether it's going to be good or bad. It may be painful in the short term, but in the big picture, the long picture, see what it would really mean for you. A lot of the time, what you thought was bad today, at the end of your life, think, wow, that was a wonderful thing which happened to me. That's happened to you so many times in your life so far. It's probably going to happen many times. Things which you thought were a disaster, afterwards you find, wow, what a great opportunity that was. You know, people actually said that the Great Fire of London, you know, in 1600 and something, was one of the best things which ever happened to that city. Because a terrible loss of life. But it made them able to plan that city in a much more beautiful way. A total clean sheet, and they could actually start from scratch and do it in a really, really beautiful way. So this is what happens sometimes with disasters. It actually gives us opportunities. And it is good, bad, who knows. That's one of the most profound teachings which I've ever known. And we don't worry so much. Instead of worrying about sending our mind off into the future, what would happen if, what would happen not, which cripples us from living our present life, we put all the attention right here, right now. This is the only time you have. This is your life happening right now. So enjoy every moment of it. Thinking about the end of the world in a Buddhist way will mean we live life much more fully. And that will finish off with one of the great sayings of the Buddha. The beginning and the end of the world. Because sometimes people ask that of Buddhists. Where do you think the world began? Big Bang? Creation or whatever. The Buddha answered that. He said, the beginning and the end of the world can be found in your own body and mind. Brilliant teaching. This is where you find the end of the world and the beginning of the world as well. Not out there, right here, inside your body and mind. Profound, brilliant teaching. This is the end of the world and the beginning of the world. Right now, the past has ended. The new world is now beginning. Every moment of your life. Then there'll be no fear. There'll be no worry. There'll be no anxiety. There'll be no stupid ideas of, you know, things are going to get worse and worse. Instead, there is the opening, the possibility of a really beautiful, fulfilling, happy, healthy, enriched life. That, to me, is the meaning of the beginning and the end of the world. Thank you for listening. Okay, any comments, questions or complaints about the end of the world? Yes. Yeah. He's saying one interpretation is it's not really the end of the world, it's a new beginning. Yeah, a new beginning for Lawrence, who can come to a monastery and become monk. A new beginning for you. But it's true, you can't have a beginning without an end. And instead of having the beginning first and then the end, I like the end first, followed by the beginning. That's the best.
Also heard.
What those Indians were doing on top of those pyramids wasn't very pleasant, was blood sacrifice. Now, those are the Aztecs. The Mayans, they didn't do the blood sacrifices. That was much, much later. So, the ones I went up to, there was no blood. I was not going to be sacrificed. I was pretty safe. And as far as the aliens are concerned, yes, I went to London in October. And once again, at Heathrow Airport, I realized, yes, there are such things as aliens. Because you can go into the line there, they have EU citizens and they have aliens. I never saw any there, but they must be expecting them because they've got the passageway through immigration for aliens. Go there, you can see it, it's there. Maybe I can actually get a picture next time. Actually, I'm missing an alien, he's going through the alien channel. Yes? Don't you think it's empathy when people say, oh, so sorry your mother died? If they knew her, I could maybe accept it was empathy. Because they would maybe know the situation. But right now, if my mother died, you know, she's still alive, if she died tomorrow and you said, oh, I'm so sorry, that would not be empathy at all. My mother has got Alzheimer's, full Alzheimer's, no real quality of life. If she died tomorrow, it would be a release for her. And it would be a cause for joy, not for sadness. If you knew the situation, like I know, it would not be sad at all. But why is it we're brainwashed that death is so sad? Sometimes it is sad. And I was at a funeral yesterday, and I said this, I've been to so many funerals because I conduct them. Now, for the last 25 years or 26 years, I don't know how many people I've pressed the button and sent them down below to be burnt or buried or stuff. And I had some great fun at funeral services. One day I'm going to write a book, My Favourite Funerals. I had some good fun at funerals. Sometimes it's very and wonderful. Two people, I think this year, from our community here, who passed away, who died. Very, very well done. They've learned all these teachings over so many years. At the end of their funeral service, the last music as they committed the coffin and as we all walked out was Life of Brian's Look on the Bright Side of Life. It's brilliant. When I die, I want that music at my funeral. Please remember that. Look on the bright side of life. Da, da, da. And that was at the funeral. It's brilliant stuff. If you haven't seen that religious movie, Please do so, especially at Christmas time, because it was a phobia. So that's brilliant. So their life was not sad when they died. It was a great sense of joy. What a great life they lived. So that's the problem is that people say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. You're not sorry. You're just acting that. It's not real empathy. Ask me, how do you feel your mum's died? Ask me, first of all. And have empathy with my joy. Oh, wonderful. Okay, yeah. Exactly, yeah, especially the English. You know, somebody bumps into me, you know, on purpose, and I'm the one who says sorry. I'm not sorry, you idiot. You should look where you're going. But you're not supposed to say that, are you? So it's absolutely true, sir. What you said is that sorry is the most overused word. And I'm very sorry that I keep using it. No, I'm not at all. So it's very, very true. And it's too often that we just get so conditioned. And just, I've mentioned this with funerals before, that every time there's a funeral service, there's always some young kids, 6, 7, 8 years of age, and it's brilliant having them in the funeral. They're running around, playing around, being naughty like kids should be. And then they see mum and dad with their face just so sad. And I see fear on those kids' face. What's going on? Why is mum just so upset? And that's where they learn their grief from. You don't need to be a sort of a PhD psychologist to see that. Learned response communicated socially from their parents and elders. But hopefully some of those kids who went to those funerals where they had a look on the bright side of life will not have that fear and grief conditioned out of them, so they can appreciate life, celebrate life, and accept death. And don't be sorry about it. Very good. One last question for Eddie. I read on the internet, that's a source of unimpeachable knowledge. End of the world mind thing, yeah. Over 2,000 year cycle. It's always in the Chinese I Ching. So China's going to end, Guatemala's going to end, but Australia's safe. Yeah. Head of a mind, there's no Mayans left. The whole civilization disappeared as Indians in Guatemala, Yucatan Indians living in that same area, but they're not sort of the holders of Mayan culture. It's totally disappeared. Yeah. Yeah, no, but nothing changes. First, 31st of December, the 1st of January, it just feels the same. Maybe you're a bit more tired. Drunk, hopefully. No, but that reminds me, on the 31st of December here, to make sure to keep you on the straight and narrow so you don't go to these parties and do stupid things. You can come to Ajahn Brahm's party. And do good things, because we're always having a party here on the 31st of December, every year for the past 20 years, Ajahn Brahm's party. We do a few stupid things, but not that stupid you do in those parties where they have alcohol and sort of do really, really stupid things. We have a bit of Buddhism in a fun way, some chanting, lots to eat and drink, non-alcoholic drinks, and we chant at midnight to bring in the new year. And every year, once we finish, just past midnight, that's when you get in your car and you try your best to find a booze bus. Just for the look on the face of that policeman when on New Year's Day, or no, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, you blow a zero reading. That's worth experiencing once in your life. So please come to Ajahn Brahm's party.